started. So my name is Julia, I use she, her pronouns, and I serve the village in program. And I am so excited to welcome Ben and Gerald for their first Living Word session that's really focusing on the Samaritan traveler. Their bios are so beautifully written. I'm just going to read them. They are crafters of word and language, and you'll see that both through the Monday Vespers that we shared together last night and also our Friday Eucharist Vespers. They helped shape that and brought that to life for the village. So Gerald Osorto has a passion for stories hidden out of sight, which drives him to work collaboratively and creatively to bring those stories to light. He comes to Holden from Ithaca College, nurturing belonging and meaning-making as Director of Religious and Spiritual Life and Executive Director for Student Equity and Belonging. Assigned to the DC Metro Synod, he will soon be the newest roster leader in the ELCA. That church is very lucky. Three words that describe Gerald: intuitive, insightful, innovator. Ben Masters is a lover of stories and sacred song and a pastor among those complicated covenant people called Presbyterians. He comes to Holden with greetings from the farmers, winemakers, and librarians beside beautiful Seneca Lake. He started baking sourdough bread long before lockdown, but the perfect pie crust still eludes him. Three words that describe Ben: hopeful, humming, homilist. Welcome, Ben and Gerald.
And one minor correction, it's actually the Minneapolis area city.
It has changed.
Sending me on to my first talk. But welcome, everyone. It's so good to be here.
Listen. The waters of Jordan. We sat down and wept for Babylon. We remember Babylon. This setting of the 137th Psalm comes to us with a bit of a change. As we sing together, we'll remember a community that was not exiled to Babylon, but from Babylon. So I invite you to echo after me, and then we'll all sing together. Listen.
By the waters of Jordan.
Blessed be.
So today we get to journey with the Samaritans and to explore the different ways they come up through the sacred texts. But before we dive into this journey, there's a few ground rules that we wanted to share with you. And I'm going to put my mic on. And there's a great Presbyterian theologian and homiletics professor, Anna Florence Carter, that has a book called Rehearsing Scripture. And she describes this practice as a theater rehearsal, but also talks about the sandbox and what are the rules that help us play well and sometimes not so well in that sandbox. So we picked a few and wanted to share those with you as we gather into this time together. Would anyone be willing to read number one?
Don't worry about language.
Don't worry about language. What does that mean for you all? What comes up when you hear that expression? Don't worry about language. In the context of a Bible study.
Pronunciation doesn't really matter as long as you get the message.
Yes. Pronunciation doesn't really matter as long as you get the message. Yeah. Others?
Sometimes some of us who aren't as educated in a certain field might not have the vocabulary, and so go ahead and, and so
yes.
Sometimes you're hesitant to say something if you don't feel you have the right vocabulary.
Excellent. It's okay if you don't have the right vocabulary. One more. Chris?
Maybe something like, the vocabulary means different things to different people, too, and some terms can trigger particular kinds of baggage, and it's good to let that go for the study time.
Different words mean different things for different people. Sometimes the same word can mean multiple things. And all of you have different translations, too, so it'll be interesting what different words will come up as we read the story together.
Yeah.
It's pretty small in here.
This will work.
Oh, yeah.
Good thing we have a backup. So who would read number two? Do I have a volunteer for number two? Sarah?
Don't worry about heresy.
Don't worry about heresy. What do we mean by that?
Don't worry about offending people with your opinion.
Don't worry about offending people, yeah.
Who defines what is heresy?
Good question, yes. We could go the traditional route, right, to the things that have been called heretic in the Christian family, but can I say something?
When Anna Florence talks about heresy, she's thinking about, we're accountable to communities, and those communities often ask us to affirm certain beliefs, and sometimes scripture is a little messy and doesn't always cohere with the Augsburg Confession or the Westminster Catechism or what have you, and so there's a freedom here.
Yeah, I think this concept to reconsider what we think we know and to be willing to ask new questions as well and push against the things that we've been used to feeling comfortable in. Number three. You want to read number three?
Questions welcome.
Yes. Questions welcome. Pretty self-explanatory, right? Number four. Anyone willing to read number four?
All levels of familiarity welcome.
Yes.
The Bible, religion, etc.
Yeah. So all are welcomed here. You could be a biblical scholar, and if you're here, welcome. And if this is your first time reading 2 Kings, welcome. And then number five. I'm willing to read number five. Yes.
Share a little, share a lot. No judgment.
No judgment, yes. Also pretty self-explanatory. But these are the ground rules that we wanted to share with you as we journey throughout this week. They'll be the ones that frame our journey with each other and with ourselves. And so let's get to it. So this first living word for the week, we'll dive into the story of the Samaritans, a multi-ethnic collection of displaced people remembered in the scriptures of Judah as heretics to this very day. Hence the title of this first living word. And we want to thank Val and Jim, who are going to read today from the second scroll of the Kings today. And feel free to follow along in your own Bibles. And the verses are up here on the poster paper. Or let the words just wash over you as you listen to the readings. So our first reader, I believe, is Val.
Yes.
Our first reading is from the second book of Kings, chapter 17, verse 24 to 28. A reading from the second scroll of the Kings. Listen. The Syrian king brought people from Babylon, Cuth, Abba, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, resettling them in the cities of Samaria, in place of the Israelites. These people took control of Samaria and settled in its cities. But when they began to live there, they didn't worship the Holy One. So the Holy One sent lions against them, and the lions began to kill them. Assyria's king was told about this. The nations you sent into exile and resettled in the cities of Samaria don't know the religious practices of the local God. That God has sent lions against them, and the lions are killing them because none of them know the religious practices of the local God. So Assyria's king commanded, return one of the priests that you exiled from there. The priest should go back and live there and should teach them the religious practices of the local God. So one of the priests who had been exiled from Samaria went back, lived in Bethel, and taught the people how to worship the Holy One. Ancient words, words for us.
Thank you, Val. So what did folks notice? What did folks hear, read? What stood out to you? And I'll look for hands. Saw Val.
The first thing I noticed when I read through it last night was the local God.
The local God, right. What else did folks notice, observe, go, huh?
So I have the New International Version here. It talks about that they weren't doing what he requires, what God. Whereas when she read it, they weren't following religious traditions.
Uh-huh.
It seems like a big difference.
Mm-hmm. What else did people notice in the reading?
That they immediately realized it was the local God who sent the lions, not that it was just...
Yes. It's not just a lion infestation. Any other observations right now? Well, let's just get situated in history. So this is in the 700s, before the Common Era. The United Kingdom of David and Solomon has been split for a few centuries now into a northern kingdom, Israel, a southern kingdom, Judah. And the northern kingdom, Israel, had the unfortunate experience of being ravaged by the Assyrian Empire. So at first, it was just a client state, but then Second Kings tells us that Hoshea, the king, stopped paying tribute to the Assyrians, which is never a good idea. So Assyria sacked the capital city of Samaria. So this is from the same chapter, chapter 17. I'm reading from the Common English Bible. In Hoshea's ninth year, the Assyrian king captured Samaria. He sent Israel into exile to Assyria, resettling them in Halah, in Gozan on the Habor River, and in the cities of the Medes. This story of forced resettlement trickles through even to today. Did anyone else grow up hearing about the 10 lost tribes of Israel? Yeah, I'm seeing some head nods. Those groups of people were forcibly resettled in these places, and then their stories stopped being recorded in our sacred scriptures in a different way than later exile communities to Babylon. But forced resettlement of Israel is not the only time that shows up. In fact, Assyria resettles people from 5 different regions in Samaria. Wow, thank you. So what's up with the lions?
What is up with the lions? That was a question that we were asking ourselves. I think one of the really fascinating things about this particular text is that it shows us that for most of human history, people have lived in a God-congested universe, right? So in this cosmology, all gods exist. Often they're tied to a particular ethnic group or land. And what's happening in this text that's really intriguing is that the acknowledgement of the local god is called henotheism. But this literal acknowledgement means the god of the land in Hebrew, literally the land that they're standing over. Right? And so that's shaping the ways that this community is making sense of who they are as they are experiencing this turmoil, this forced resettlement in this particular text.
It seems to me that stories like this from the Bible are still being believed in the light that God is causing anything bad to happen.
So we do get this sense from Scripture that God is behind everything, good and bad. And we have different takes on that in the Scriptures. Definitely in the prophets to the northern kingdom of Israel, lions show up again. God loves using lions to make a point. And so this is something that maybe we hold lightly, or maybe coheres with our own religious experience. I heard an interesting observation. What was that phrase that you have in your Bible that was different than local religious practice?
That he was not doing, or that the people do not know what he requires.
The people do not know what God requires. And so that word in Hebrew is mishpat. And maybe you have heard it in the sense of like case law or regulation. And so in the Torah, God gives the people mishpatim, which are ways to live in community. And so what God requires, what the practice around worshiping this God and living in community is. All right. Let's have our second reading. Things are about to get juicy.
The juicy second reading is from 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 29 through 34 and 40 through 41. A reading from the second scroll of the Kings. Listen. But each nationality still made its own gods. They set them up in the shrines that the people of Samaria had made. Each nationality did this in whichever cities they lived. The Babylonian people made the god Sukoth-Benoth. The Kuthian people made Nergal, and the people from Hamath made Ashima. The Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak. The Sepharvites burned their children alive as a sacrifice to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the Sepharvite gods. They also worshiped the Holy One, but they appointed priests for the shrines from their whole population. These priests worked in the houses at the shrines. So they worshiped the Holy One, but they also served their own gods according to the religious practices of the nations from which they had been exiled. They are still following their former religious practices to this very day. They don't really worship the Holy One, nor do they follow the regulations, the case laws, the Torah, or the commandment that the Holy One commanded the children of Jacob, whom God renamed Israel. They wouldn't listen. Instead, they continued doing their former religious practices. So these nations worship the Holy One, but they also serve their idols. The children and the grandchildren are doing the very same thing their parents did. And that's how things still are today. Ancient words. Words for us.
So, we just heard this juicy passage. What's some of the juice that's dripping down our chins? What did people hear, notice?
They obviously realized that, you know, that God had sent these lions to kill all of them, and so they needed to, you know, start worshiping him. But they did it half in. They're like, okay, well, we get it, God, we'll do that, but we still got these other gods that we're going to keep, you know, our priests and our traditions towards, because we got to go for them too, not just the, you know, the Holy One, as they call them in that tradition. So
yeah,
they went for it, but they didn't really go for it
enough to ward off lions.
Yeah, enough to get rid of the other gods.
What else did we hear or notice?
I thought very accountable to many gods.
There's accountability, right? We live in a God-congested universe. If I have a God that's connected to my ethnicity, well, why wouldn't I acknowledge that God and still that ethnicity, right? Maybe.
That acknowledgement, I think, is what really struck me.
Yeah.
Yes, Sarah.
Just on that side comment, I don't think the Sepharvites must have lasted long if they were burning their children.
Right. This reminds me of the poem Howl by Allen Ginsberg, right? Because Ginsberg, does anyone remember that God who eats children? Molech, right? So maybe it's something that people who recorded these scriptures just like thought, you know, those people up north, they really like to like sacrifice their children. Maybe to Molech, maybe to these other gods. I don't know if those northerners are any good.
So a little bit of nuance in terms of what's happening in the text. So here, Assyria has ravaged the capital city of Samaria, right? So there's this understanding, I talk with my hands, so like this, it's okay, look up there. Understanding that the Samaria has been wiped, but archaeological findings show that not all of the surrounding towns were actually destroyed. And so within the rubble, it is very possible that people, Samarians, resettled in this area, and they would have had eventually created a common shared culture with their Israelite neighbors, the non-Judeans. So they learned how to coexist, right? in an act of survival, in an act of saying, we belong here, we know how to navigate this context, we can do this, and we can figure out a way to hold on to our sense of who God is alongside our neighbor. And so this common culture based around the city of Samaria would later be called Samaritan. Not by the Samaritans themselves, but by those that were the outsiders looking in, those that lived there and those that live now, the Samaritans, would be considered this term, which is an exonym, which is a term that outsiders use to refer to them. But it's not their own reference point. So the name itself.
Yeah, what did they call themselves?
Samaritan Israelites.
Yeah, notice the continuing lineage of the northern kingdom of Israel.
So the Samaritan Israelites also see themselves deeply connected to this land of Israel. And to this very day, as we will learn throughout this week, that history continues to unfold in the ways that we ourselves have come to understand who the Samaritan is. Right? And the ways that our reference points have been shaped by this attempt to erase them, right? To see that they no longer exist in the imagination of the context of the nation of Israel, but they're still there. Samaritan Israelites.
So did anyone notice that we hopped into a DeLorean and did some time travel? So we went from an account about the past, this is what these people did, to an observation about the present. This is what's happening to this very day. That shift in language, that also accompanies this liberal use of the word they. They do this. They, their parents, their grandparents, their children. So there's an othering in this language. When we noticed this time travel and this they language, we asked a question borrowed from our teachers in community organizing. That question is, who benefits? Who benefits from this kind of othering language? Who benefits from including in the historical record a little side comment, oh, they're still like this? Well, the scrolls of the kings were likely compiled by refugees from the kingdom of Israel. So when Assyria came through, not everyone was exiled, and not everyone stayed in their towns. Some fled to the southern kingdom of Judah. And so likely we have stories from those people in the northern kingdom that are edited by scribes of the southern kingdom of Judah. I'm curious, why would this southern kingdom have any kind of interest in painting those Samaritans, those others, in a less than positive light? What do you all think? Who benefits?
The authors.
The authors. Maybe if we can establish that the worship of the Holy One that's centered in Jerusalem, in Judah, is the authentic worship of the Holy One, well then maybe that makes our northern neighbors less competitive. And that's something that we see in the first scroll of the Kings, even before the Samaritans arrive. People in the south are always saying, it's people in the north, I don't know if they're doing it right.
The people with religious power, scribes and Pharisees.
Right.
If the other is wrong, you need us to be right. Mm-hmm. You need to come over here and be to do it right.
Right. Scribes. Scribes have enormous power. They tell the story. And so those people who tell the story can tell a story that they hope will shape future generations. How does this feel right now, knowing that it's possible in a text that's considered sacred by many of our religious communities, certainly mine, that there would be some bias? Are folks feeling, or folks feeling,
It feels very human.
Does feel very human. Yeah, you're like, oh, maybe this is, maybe God's holding this up as a mirror, right? Yeah, you wanted to say something a little bit about the Samaritan Israelites to this very day.
Yeah, so as I shared earlier, Samaritan Israelites still exist.
Here, if you would take your mask off when you talk.
How's this? Is this better?
Yes.
Thank you. What was I saying? Samaritan Israelites still exist. They're the perpetual foreigner in this story. And if you think about their journey throughout the last 30, 40, 50 years in the state of Israel, they've always exerted their right to belong in Israel because their understanding of who they are, deeply connected to that land, has remained the same, right? And then for many, many years, they were considered not part of the state of Israel, but they've continued to make that claim. And I think it's important because as we journey through this Luke story later on in the week, we have having this context of this is an encounter not just with another person, not just a stranger, but someone who the world sees as a foreigner. And the name itself that we use to describe them is a name that's been imposed by someone else. Right, and even in the text, right, in the translations, because the Samaritans have had some influence, and so there are certain Hebrew references in the text itself, the translators would say, denote, like it's a secular variant, right? It is not of authentic Jewish writing. And so even in the text, as the translations have unfolded, we've seen this notion of the Samaritans' own sense of what's happened, particularly in the Pentateuch, has been noted as not of. But it's there, it's a variant, it's different. Go ahead.
What's the Pentateuch?
Genesis.
Exodus.
Exodus. Deuteronomy. Leviticus.
Deuteronomy.
One more Numbers. I think we got all five.
Yeah.
Good job.
So Pentateuch, right? There's Penta 5 in there, but at least in my tradition, we talk a lot about the Torah, right? That's the instruction contained within those five books. And the Samaritan Israelites, they also read from the Torah, but their Torah looks different than the Torah based in Judah. It used to be that scholars would say, well, the one that came out of Judah was the original, and the one that emerged in Samaria was just tweaked. You know, what folks now understand or accept is that these two writings emerged simultaneously from an even older tradition. And so tomorrow, when we meet Fotini, who has worshipped on Mount Gerizim, as Samaritan Israelites still do today, she'll know her Torah that God asked the people of Israel to worship here, not in places like that other Torah, the one from Jerusalem. And you know, I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about the legal status of Samaritan Israelites in the state of modern Israel.
So until very recently, they were required to convert to Judaism to be considered citizens in the state of Israel. And I think it's still the case. I can't remember now if that law was changed, but my understanding is that there's Samaritans, I mean, they wouldn't consider themselves Jewish either, right? They're Samaritan Israelites. Mm-hmm. They would consider themselves as being descendants that follow the law coming from Moses. And so they're the original receivers of that message. But yeah, in terms of the state of Israel, there has been this, again, to claim a sense of who you are and a sense of connection and agency, you have to convert to Judaism.
And this was really important in the right to return.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when the modern state of Israel was established, at first Samaritan Israelites were offered citizenship, and then that was revoked in the 1970s, and there have been legal cases ever since then about who belongs in a modern democratic Jewish state. And we could ask that same question, who belongs in our communities? Let's do some group reflection.
There was. So we want you to ask that question to each other and amongst yourselves, and take it a little further. How might your community be responding to this question, or not talking about, to this question of refugees, the foreigner, the immigrant? How is your community receiving or not? And so we invite you to turn to your neighbor and spend some time reflecting with each other, and then we'll regroup back here to share out loud what's come up for you. So we'll do 3-4 minutes. Right, Ben? 5 minutes?
Yeah.
5 minutes, we have time.
And I'm writing the question up here, just in case you're like me and
you
think, what just happened? Let's come back in a minute. Let's come back together. I would love to hear what folks have talked about in their groups. I can see that there's some really energetic conversation. And so I know this is going to be a good group this week. So what came up in your group conversations? What really popped and buzzed?
Well, the first question, how is your community talking about or not refugees? Well, the ELCA just put out an email asking for people to take in Afghan refugees. So we just discussed what that means, what that involves, having the resources, not being afraid, trusting. It involves a lot. And so who does that? Who's going to step forward?
An excellent question to chew on this week. What else came up in your conversations?
Many communities are talking about it, but not taking any steps further. They're just talking.
Wow, that makes me think about those towns around the city of Samaria. How might they have been talking about those newcomers, and they chose to invite those newcomers into community. And so that's an interesting choice. I'm curious about how folks think about some communities in the US. Are there communities in the US, or maybe in your own contexts, that are treated like perpetual foreigners? I think about last March, when the shootings in the Atlanta area murdered several Asian American women. The text for me that week was about, for preaching, was about some Greeks who came to speak to Jesus. And I noticed that in the Gospel of John, some Greeks didn't have a name. We didn't know how many there were, if there were men or women, if they were Greek immigrants or Jews living in Greece. So I'm thinking about how our scriptures reflect back this very human tendency to say, well, those people, just a lump category. What comes up for you all?
I live in in Seattle, and in an area of the city that there seems to be a conflict as to whose community is this, and who belongs, and who gets to tell the stories, and who gets to use the city's resources to do what. And I mean, we all live there, and we've all lived there for, some of us have lived there for quite a long time. But who gets to say, this is my neighborhood and I will be the leader here, causes conflict.
Right. And meanwhile, Seattle is also the place of the Duwamish Confederacy, and they're still not acknowledged by the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a recognized nation. So Seattle, oh, you all are just living into these questions. I love it. Was there another hint?
It's tangentially related to your refugees and who they are, but I kept thinking about the many religious splits in the Christian family and the pieces of our own community that get othered, you know, like those people that, you know, worship that way, who are they don't have it, or those people that don't do gay marriage, or those people that, there's lots of ways we other within our religious community, as this story in 2 Kings illustrates.
Right. And on sneak peek on Thursday, when we talk about those priests and Levites, those of us who are Protestant will probably recognize anti-Roman Catholic rhetoric buried under that anti-Judaism. So many layers, so many questions. I really appreciate you all sharing with each other from your experience. And I'm really excited to travel with you this week. How about you?
I am too. So I think one of the things I've noticed is that you have really given yourselves the space to shape the kinds of questions that you get to ask as we go into the text of the traveler, the Samaritan traveler, or maybe we would say it differently now that we know a little bit more, right? Maybe we would say the Samaritan Israelite, the perpetual foreigner, forced to travel. That carries a different tone of how we experience our own selves in that journey that we have chosen to embark on when we arrived yesterday. So I invite you to think about that as you think about this week, as you think about the different conversations that you have. One other question that came up that I think is also really helpful is, what are the biases that we carry, right? The text itself gave us a little glimpse as to the biases that the scribes had in writing a particular story. And the third question that I'm wrestling with is, what does this mean for Holden? What does it mean for Holden that is this beautiful place that welcomes all, but can it truly welcome all? What are the barriers that it may be creating where our neighbor, the perpetual foreigner, cannot access right next door to us? And that's something I think that I'm carrying as I experience this place for the first time, that for many years felt very, very distant, very unattainable to even consider the trip here. And here I am now too. So I'm excited. I look forward to this journey. We are excited. We've been talking about this, it feels like, for more than a year, but it's only been 6-7 months. And we're still tweaking things, but we will close with the song that we opened as a time to say thank you and journey onward.
So as we sing this song, you might think of, you might use this song as a way to pray for refugees who are leaving Afghanistan, who are mourning the fact that they are now resettled by a different river. Or you might be praying for folks in your neighborhood, in your cities, who are feeling foreign. So together, let's sing By the Waters of Jordan.
By the waters of Jordan, we sat down and wept, and wept for Babylon. We remember Babylon.
Travel in peace.
Thank you.
Yeah. See you tomorrow.
Coffee break at 10.